So tonight I want to talk about equanimity, which is the fourth of the Brahmaviharas, these noble mind states I've been talking about for the last few weeks. It is in some ways sort of the culmination of the mental practice of mindfulness. It occurs in several different lists. Buddhist teachings is full of lists, but it's always like the last one. The ten paramis, the seven factors of awakening, the four Brahmaviharas. These are all places where you see the last thing is always equanimity. So it seems like, oh, this must be somewhat important, since it's at the end of all these lists. It's like the culmination of the process in many ways. And so I want to spend some time talking about it. First of all, I want to read you a definition. This is from Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness, which I actually really like a lot. So, equanimity is a spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be present fully with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world and our lives. So I'll read that again. Equanimity is the spacious stillness of mind, a radiant calm that allows us to be present with all the different changing experiences that constitute our world and our lives. So I like this definition for several reasons. To start with, the phrase, the very beginning of this thing has a phrase, spacious stillness, which I think is a wonderful description. When you're in a state of equanimity, your mind is still focused, yet it's spacious. It can take in everything. It's not narrow kind of focus. It's sort of a wide angle focus, I suppose you can think of it that way. There's room for everything that arises. There's no judging it, no separating it out, no only this is allowed. Nothing's rejected. There's another definition, this one by Rebecca Bradshaw, that emphasizes this particular aspect of mind. Equanimity is continuous accommodation to the truth of the present moment. An equanimous heart mind can connect with this world and all its changes with balance, poise, grace, and flexibility. It's a nice list, eh? Balance, poise, grace, and flexibility. With equanimity, we learn to trust deeply and relax into our capacity to flow with the river of change. This ends with that classic Buddhist image that you see all through the suttas, where the flow of what's arising and passing away in our mind, that constant flow, it's the river of change. That's what we're in the midst of all the time. That's what we're constantly experiencing, is the river of change. And equanimity means we can flow with the river of change. We don't struggle against it. I think that's a good way to think of it as well. Then in Sharon's definition, there's another phrase that she uses called that's radiant calm. So not only is our mind focused and still, not only is it, have this aspect of spacious stillness, but it's radiant. It's radiant calm. So we become a source of this wholesome mind state for others. If you're in a state of equanimity, others around you pick up on that and benefit from it. And this is where the practice leads us. The practice leads us to this place of equanimity where we become radiators of calmness. Many people, when you talk about meditation, many people say, oh, why are you bothering to meditate? You're just sitting there, gazing at your navel or whatever it is you're doing. You're not being useful in the world. It's very sort of selfish, right? You should be, doing something useful. But actually, I think what could be more useful in this world right now, obviously, than creating an aura of calm and stillness all around you? What does the world need more than this? What? It's like, it's so clear to me that that's what the world needs, is more calmness, more stillness, more radiant calm, more spacious stillness. And if we can, through our practice, start to sort of let that energy flow out into the world, I can't think of anything more useful to do right now. For me, at least. I mean, maybe I'm not the most activist kind of guy, and that might have something to do with it too. But it's like, it just seems to me like so obvious, like, well, whoa, this is what the world needs. And then in Sharon's definition, there's the final phrase, to be fully present with all the different changing experiences. Fully present. This could be a really good definition of not suffering. To be fully present with whatever's arising. In other words, to be able to see it for what it is and not be thrown off by it, either by reaching for it to grasp it or push it away. That seems kind of useful too. Otherwise you suffer. This is a definition of suffering is not doing that, to not being fully present, to being shut down from the ever-changing and different changing experiences. Because we suffer because we cling to things that we don't want to go away in this river of constantly flowing river of change, right? We cling to some things and we push things away, neither of which work in any sort of permanent way at all, or even semi-permanent. Usually this, they rebound and make things worse. We don't want to flow with the river of change. In fact, we do everything we can to pretend the river of change doesn't exist, let alone flow with it. And what equanimity brings is this understanding that everything is always changing, is impermanent. And it's like, once we somehow see that, then we start moving towards, this is like the first step towards enlightenment. Once the mind is equanimous, then the factors of enlightenment can really start waking up and being actual moments of clear insight start arising. And it's because when we're equanimous, that's a definition of not suffering, of the mind being this still, pure, calm space. So, like the other Brahma Viharas, equanimity has what's called a near enemy, right? Remember, a near enemy is something that sort of on the exterior looks like, but is not. It's something that masquerades as equanimity in a sense. This is indifference. Unfortunately, many texts, and so you might see this in many, if you're a reader of texts and translations and things, you might see the words, the Pali upekkha or the Sanskrit upeksham, translated not as equanimity but as indifference. But these translations are actually incorrect. Outwardly, indifference might look like the same, that appearance of calmness. But indifference is a rejection of the world. It's a strong sense of, oh, I don't care. So it's not at all going with the flow, not going with flowing with the river of change. It's like just ignoring it. Who cares? It isn't spacious at all. In fact, it's quite narrow and self-serving. It doesn't accommodate the present moment, as one of the definitions said. So equanimity is infused with loving kindness, a sense of caring for all living beings. So even though I'm calm, it doesn't mean my heart isn't wide open. Even though I'm calm and still, my heart is wide open and taking in everything. So, far enemy, remember the far enemy is the opposite. Traditionally, the far enemy of equanimity is considered to be restlessness. I think this is interesting too. This is like, I can't sit still. I'm flitting from this to that. I got to do this. I got to do that. How about this? Never being able to settle, and there's no calm there. There's no stillness there at all. It's like just, and people sometimes sort of almost glorify restlessness as, oh, look at all the different things. I can do seven things at once, right? I'm a multitasker. This can be restlessness manifesting, essentially. And it means that you're not, there's no focus, there's no stillness there at all. It's the opposite. And restlessness, of course, manifests in the body as not being able to be still, the opposite of stillness. When your mind is equanimous, your body will be very still. My experiences of it have been to the point where, your breath almost, it doesn't stop, but it seems like it stopped. It's almost as if it's so subtle, the breath is so subtle that it's really hard to even notice, but it's still there. It's just this very still, calm breath. It's only, and it slows down a lot, so which is part of that stillness and calmness as well. And so you'll know that's a very good physical cue for, oh, this is what equanimity feels like, this stillness, because the breath has gone so still. As opposed to restlessness, where you can't sit still at all, which is the opposite. It's a physical, my mother used to tell me sometimes when I was restless, that I had ants in my pants, and that's a pretty good definition of what it feels like sometimes. Like you're literally, you're sitting and you go, oh no, this isn't right. I got to move my knee 3 millimeters to the left and the other knee, and we just have to keep shifting position to find the perfect position, or we have to keep shifting our mind state. Oh no, I can't think about that. I should think about this. And what about this? That's restlessness. And it manifests both on the mental and the physical level, which of course are interrelated. The interesting thing about equanimity is it binds the other three Brahma Viharas together. It's the balancing factor of the other Brahma Viharas. So without equanimity, loving kindness, metta, can very quickly sort of devolve into desire, where, which is, remember, the near enemy. It's like, without equanimity, I start to fall into, well, yeah, I'll wish that person loving kindness, but they better wish it back. That's desire. It's like I have this sort of sweet energy sending out into the world, but I'm expecting something in return, which is not loving kindness at all. That's just plain old desire in this sort of sweet way. Compassion without equanimity shifts to one of its two areas. It either shifts to pity on one side, which is just sort of standing back and looking down at those poor people, so we're looking, we're above, and these people who are suffering are below. Or it shifts into being overwhelmed, like I can't handle this sort of energy, that we have to be careful with in terms of practicing compassion, is that we don't let ourselves get to that place where we just become so overwhelmed by the suffering that now we can't function, because that's not useful either. So we, because remember, equanimity is calm, it's still, but it's open-hearted and totally connected. And then with sympathetic joy, this is where we can be so joyful that we sort of fall into exuberance, which is the near enemy of sympathetic joy. Remember from last week, exuberance is just like sort of being all over the place, being sort of wild and giddy, and not having that sort of solid foundation of stillness and calm. And I'm not saying you should never be wild and giddy, by the way. Sometimes it's kind of fun to be wild and giddy for a minute or two. You sit around and laugh with someone and you just sit there and giggle. But as a way of operating in the world, it's not very effective at all. And we have to sort of let that come down to, this is joy. I love, like, this is joy. This is good. This is a wholesome mindset. I'm experiencing joy right now without going over the edge, so to speak. So equanimity keeps everything in balance. And all of I talked earlier about how compassion was just loving kindness directed towards someone who's something, some situation of suffering. And sympathetic joy was just loving kindness directed towards something, some source of joy. So they're all interrelated and interweaved. We separate them into these four things so we can talk about them. But the truth is, they're all like, as if you had a four-sided coin, whatever. There's some sort of geometric object that has only four sides, a tetrahedron, that's what it is. So if it's like a tetrahedron where all four sides are all there and they're all interconnected, but you only see one at a time and talk about it, but really, without the other three sides, the thing would fall down. So that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about how they somehow all bind together and work together. So, what is the significance of maintaining equanimity? Not in our practice, where it's pretty obvious that the mind is calm and still, then insights can arise. What about just in plain old daily life? How is the equanimous mind important in our daily life world? Well, I want to read you something from Joseph Goldstein here. This is from his book Mindfulness. The first way we experience the cool, restful quality of equanimity is in the peace and balance it brings to our daily lives. Each of us is touched by what are called the eight worldly vicissitudes. These are endlessly changing conditions of gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. When equanimity is developed, we ride these waves with balance and ease. Without it, we're tossed about by the waves, often crashing into the changing circumstances of our lives. So this is actually quite a famous list, this teaching of the eight vicissitudes: gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, and pleasure and pain. These are all unwholesome places we go if we're not careful, if we don't have equanimity. So let's think about them a little more. Gain and loss. Well, I mean, often we think of gain and loss as sort of like a, you know, oh, gee, the stock market's really down like 20% in the last 5 months. Oh, no. And people jump off cliffs and things, right? Or, you know, I was just reading an article in the Times before I, you know, this evening, and the Bitcoin world is down 40% in the last 4 months. People who bought Bitcoins have lost 40% of their money already, which is like, so thank you. I'm glad I don't do that sort of stuff, you know. But it's like, but it's not, it's a lot more than that. We think about gain and loss in the context of many aspects of our life. You know, it's not just financial. For instance, let's talk about our practice. Here we are, we're sitting, it's just one of those sitting periods where everything is just smooth and calm and still. It's just great, right? And our mind goes, oh, that was a good sit. And we think we've somehow gained something. I finally got it. I figured it out. Now this is what my practice is going to be like. Because I've had that incredibly calm, still period, and I know how to get there now. So I've gained something, right? Then the next sit, or the next day, or the next week, or the next retreat, or the next whatever, it's nothing like that. In fact, what happens is we have a bad sit instead. Oh no, I just lost my ability to have a good sit. Oh no. And then we get all upset about this. This is just the natural flow of practice. You know, things come and things go. Things arise and they pass away. It's not like we can sort of keep anything, even our good sit. Over time, our practice tends towards being, quote, better, more calm, more still, more focused. But I even hesitate to use the word better there. It's like we get caught up in believing somehow that there's something we got to figure out here. If I just get this right, then everything, my practice will be just great. I have to gain something. Instead, we just have to practice. We just have to go with the flow of the river of change. And the river of change flows sometimes in this nice calm space with pools, and sometimes it's like rapids and rocks. This is the way it is. You know, and it's not like, oh, I'm sorry, I only want the calm pools and the sun. You know, we got to accept the fact that there's ups and downs all the time. And there's nothing to gain and nothing to lose. There's just the practice itself. Ah, next pair. Praise and blame. It's so easy to get caught by these. We get praised and we go, oh, yep, that felt great. I did a good job. I'm a wonderful person, wherever your mind goes, right? And then once we get blamed for something, or told we didn't do a good job, or what about this, and you shouldn't have done it that way, then we get all whacked out of whack, and like, oh my God, I'm bad, I didn't do good. We start blaming ourselves, we start blaming others for blaming us. We get wound up in that way. We somehow think that praise and blame are important. It's a really, both of these are quite dangerous mind states that we get caught in, because they're so sort of addictive. I'll keep doing it this way because every time I do this way, I get praised. I won't do it that way anymore because every time I do it that way, I get blamed. Even though there might be perfectly equally valid ways of doing things. But like, what do I experience from others when I do things becomes the way I decide how to do things, instead of just doing what I know to be right. And on an even more insidious level, I suppose, both praise and blame, our reactions to them, both just create stronger senses of a separate self. I'm good, I just got praised, or I'm bad, I just got blamed. There's always an I there. There's always this me being in reaction to what these other people said. And so it's leads directly to selfing, to creating a stronger sense of a separate self, either way. So, and that's why with equanimity, these both just roll off our backs. It's not like, oh, I'm trying to get one or I'm trying to get the other. They're just at the same time, we understand, oh, this is the interesting part, that it's going to happen. Some people are going to praise you and some people are going to blame you. No matter what you do, no matter how you do it, just go online and look at anything that anybody posts online, right? There's always someone who's going to, rant and rave about how you're a clueless idiot and you don't know what you're saying, blah, blah, blah. And there's going to be people who praise you and say, oh, this is wonderful, you're so smart. It's just the way, that's the whole nature of the online experience, almost exclusively, unfortunately. And people think, oh, I got 50 likes on that thing, that post. That was so great, I got 50 likes. And then you find that someone else has got 237 likes on a post, and oh, what's wrong with me? I only got, so you get caught in that praise and blame cycle again. Praising and blaming yourself, which we also are quite skillful at sometimes. Then the last of these was fame and disrepute. So the third. So fame and disrepute are just like praise and blame, but on a larger scale, right? And we, our whole culture, our whole like the dominant culture is all about people who are famous and people who are in disrepute. Saying this person's, like the building up certain people and making them famous. And tearing other people down and just covering them with disrepute because of something they did or something they said or something we perceive they did or said or whatever. These are harder to deal with because they're much more seductive. Fame is a, it's like everybody wants to have their 15 minutes of fame, that phrase. But it's like, it's so seductive to want to be famous, and it's also so seductive to not ever be in disrepute. These are things we struggle with if we're not careful. The thing about fame is it's just what other people think. It's nothing to do with you or your reality of what you are doing or saying. And the same with disrepute. It's just someone else's opinion. Totally just them. It's their stuff bouncing off whatever it is you said or did. That's all it is. But it's like, it's so easy to think, oh, it would be nice to be maybe just a bit more famous. I've caught myself at times thinking, wouldn't it be great if some famous person found out I was teaching and came to one of my classes and then told all their famous friends, and all of a sudden I'm in Hollywood at someone's mansion teaching. It's like the mind just goes there just like that, because it's like what our culture says we should want. And it just and disrepute is just the opposite. We don't want that, and so we go to great lengths. I just speaking of people who are famous, John McCain. Oh, no, just a politician. He was a nice guy, it seemed to me. But apparently, I just read this article. I'm a big New York Times fan, so in the time where apparently he'd actually denied, outright denied, with his wife sitting right there, that he'd ever had this affair with this woman. This was during the 2012. Yeah, the 2012 presidential election. And he actually told this guy who was his assistant to back him up. And they did. And, he lost the election anyway, but, he died and he was like this big hero. And this guy said, 10 years later, this has been bothering me for 10 years that I actually lied for this guy because he asked me to. Because he didn't want the disrepute, which would damage his fame. There's nothing worse than being famous and going to disrepute. It's like taking the deep dive, all of a sudden. And people go to incredible lengths to avoid disrepute and do very sometimes quite unwholesome and unskillful things. And all of us on a much smaller scale probably do exactly the same thing. The last of these pairs, pleasure and pain. Well, my notes here say changes are inevitable. What's the central teaching of the Buddha, right? Things are always changing. Sometimes we get some pleasure, and then we get some pain. This is simply the cycle of life. This is like what? It's perfectly natural, and it's not our fault. Or it's not, we don't, the pleasure isn't a reward, and the pain isn't a punishment. It's just the natural cycle of life manifesting. But we get caught in thinking pleasure's good, pain's bad. If I get pleasure, I must be good. If I get pain, I must be bad. This is where an incredible amount of self-judgment arises. And it's just not true. Stuff just happens. We go through this cycle, and sometimes it's great, and sometimes it isn't. And it isn't fair at all. And we sometimes think that somehow things should be fair, right? Fair is just this concept we have that somehow there's some magical deity or something that's sort of making sure everything comes out even for everybody. It's not. Life isn't fair. Life is never fair. Forget about the idea that life is fair. Just we sometimes we're going to be on that upper slope, and sometimes we're going to be down on the bottom slope. It's just the way it is. So the to be knocked out of equanimity in either of those extremes Lots of pleasure, lots of pain. Now we've lost equanimity if we're not careful. So all of these things, all this whole list, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain, these are all things we have to mindfully, here's mindfulness, mindfully be aware that these things arise and that we have to not get caught by them because they knock us out of equanimity. So it's like this is where mindfulness fits into this whole process. It's like if I'm really mindful and I see my mind going, oh, I'm great, or oh, I'm terrible, either extreme, or oh, I just got something extra, isn't that great, or oh, I just lost something, or whatever pairs are being activated here. That's just our mind wandering. That's all. So, what about equanimity as a practice? You know, all the Brahma Viharas are practices, right? So equanimity has this really interesting phrase that, you know, like all the Brahma Vihara practices, you have some sort of phrase you repeat. So the equanimity phrase is, you are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. I'll repeat that. You are the owner of your karma. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. Or in using I instead of you, I am the owner of my karma. My happiness or unhappiness depends on my actions, not on my wishes. This is a pretty tough statement, right? It's like, and it's not, you know, we can sort of go, yeah, I can see how that sort of applies to people out there. But then think about someone close to you, a relative, a child, a partner, a parent, and see how this applies in your relationship to them. Oops. Not so easy anymore. You know, to be able to be so equanimous that you can see that that other person who you'd really like to be happy, who you really want to be happy, it's their happiness or unhappiness depends on their actions, not on your wishes. This is a difficult thing to take in because we sort of, you know, part of us want to just make everybody happy all the time, right? That's like that's how we are, you know? And certainly it's much stronger for women than men because this is sort of part of the cultural ideal of what women are supposed to do. They're supposed to make everybody else happy, right? That's like moms and wives, that's their job, to make their parents and their happy, make their parents happy and their partners happy and whatever, you know, their kids happy. But you can't. And I'm not saying that you can't do things that could potentially lead towards them being happier. And I'm not saying you shouldn't do nice things for other people at all. I'm not saying that at all. But in the end, it's totally out of your control. It's up to them. This is a hard thing to take in our daily lives because we so want to be the one that brings them happiness. And in many small ways, we can bring them moments of happiness. You know? No, dear, I'll do the dishes tonight. You relax. You know, just some little thing like that. Sometimes you can do these little things for people all the time, right? Or holding the door for someone when you're in a store and just hold the door and let them go through first. Or you two cars are heading for the same parking spot and let the other person go. These are the little things you can do, but you can't actually make them happy. They have to make themselves happy. This is something that's difficult for us to deal with. As I said, on a general scale, we look at the world and we go, yeah, this makes perfect sense. And then we get into our personal relationships and it's like, oh, wait a second. I'm not so sure I like this anymore. And that's just, well, because we're human beings again. And we want those around us, those close to us, to be happy. And we can create causes and conditions such that they might become happy, but we can't make them happy. It just doesn't work that way. Your happiness or unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes. This is an interesting meditation. When I did a long Brahma Vihara practice, I did 10 days of each of the four Brahma Viharas. This was like, it seems like, oh, it shouldn't be that hard, but it's actually quite intense practice because you're really starting to see how much of our habitual actions are going around trying to make other people happy. Instead of just being a radiator of calmness. You know, a radiator of equanimity, which will naturally makes people happy, and we don't have to try to do anything. We just be who we are. It's a different idea. So the other significance is what does equanimity do in terms of our meditation practice? Well, it's when the mind gets to this equanimous state, maybe initially it's just like a flash of equanimity and then, you know, we're back to being restless or whatever. And over time, as we practice more and more, this is more something that occurs that we can, I won't say create, we can create causes and conditions just that equanimity more readily arises and stays for longer periods of time. That's part of what the practice does. And then once we're in this state of equanimity, then it's so much easier to see and have insight into the three characteristics. You know, we start to see more clearly how everything's impermanent, how everything's unsatisfactory, that there's nothing that in the end will make us happy in terms of external things, that everything's unreliable, and that when we really start to look closely, there's no self there to have to worry about anyway. There's this great saying. I love this saying. This is how I forget. This is some teacher. I forget who it was. It says, "No self, no problems." I think it's just a great way that. Oh wait, yeah, that's an interesting way to think about. No self, no problem. What a relief to not have to maintain that self all the time. Wouldn't that be nice? So what I'm saying is, from a state of equanimity, the practice becomes much less about the content of what's arising in the mind and body, and much more about the underlying process of what's really going on. When we start to see the patterns of the mind much more clearly. But equanimity gives us the space to do that. It's why it's emphasized so strongly. It's because it's like a stepping stone into a deeper practice. So I want to finish, as always, just by reading a poem. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. This is called Remember This. Vast and changeless is the ground of being. Vast and changeless the ground of being is not rocked by ripples on the pond. The firmament from which we spring, the divinity at the heart of things, doesn't wax or wane with mind states or wither in the wind. We come from stronger stuff than feelings. Essence does not fail or fade, diminish or trade reality for illusion. We are wordless, wide, and wise beyond time. Within us is a flame of truth that never dies. Let that be the focal point of life. Let that be the light that guides us from the shadows. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for joining me.